Hey, welcome to the show. You're listening to the Rusick Podcast. We are a roots music podcast based out of Nashville, Tennessee, where we talk to the local music scene and beyond.
Today we have Patrick Weathers. He is a musician, actor, and a comedian.
He's worked alongside acts such as The Meters and Run DMC. He's also a Saturday Night Live alum, and he's been in movies such as The Campaign with Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis.
If you're listening to this on Spotify or any other platform, you're going to want to head over onto our YouTube channel at Rusick Podcast. Here we have live performances of Patrick as well as all of our other guests, so go on over there, check it out.
You know, Rick Danko was just such a fun-loving, sweet guy.
So I'm sorry, who of the band did you meet? Because that the band is my favorite group.
I met all of them, and I sure did.
Is unbelievable.
And you know, at different times, but I originally met almost the entire band. Well, it was after Robbie had left.
Okay.
At the Lone Star, but I met Robbie later at a birthday party for Smart Martin Scorsese.
Oh, okay.
And it was also the screening of the movie Casino.
Okay.
Love that movie.
And Millicent, I was just telling you about, was in Casino, by the way. I forgot that. Millicent Sheridan. I just did the Watching Marita. Mm-hmm. She played the hooker that they set the politician up with. I think he's a senator. Yeah. And I went with her. That was a really interesting night, man, I'll tell you.
I'm sure that was wild.
And it turned out there was a girl that I dated in college, and she was working as an assistant to Martin Scorsese.
Oh, it's such a small world.
It really is absolutely insane. And of course, I think the real star and surprise of that movie was Sharon Stone. How well she did in it, and she was really a beautiful woman. And she was there, and she kept kind of, you know, looking at me like maybe she knew me or something. And I was just a nobody, but I was there. I looked pretty good at the time, you know, I was younger. And but anyway, she was kind of lingering back, and she was looking at me, and I was looking at her, and she said, they all like left, and it's just now me and her. And she said, I lost an earring, and they're from Harry Winston's. They're $1 million. Can you help me? And I'm like, yeah. So I hand up on the carpet with Sharon Stone, and we're going around like this looking for that earring on the floor. And they're all there, happy birthday to you. And Robbie's in there, you know, and Martin Scorsese's in there. And that was true about Martin Scorsese, because the song is on the Queen of Tupelo, Red Miata. And it turns out that he really liked that song.
Okay.
And he'd have all his meetings in his big Mercedes, and he had that on the top of his CD playlist at the time.
Oh, wow.
And he'd play Red Miata.
Is it little things like that that stick out to you as being meaningful? I just think that has to be the coolest. That has to be the coolest fucking thing in the world
to know
that.
There are things. Well, I'll tell you how that happened, and it's kind of a sad story, but back to the Sharon Stone thing, you know, we found the earring.
You found the earring, thank God.
And they were loaners from Harry Winston.
You know, okay.
And when they travel with that kind of stuff, like they're at the event, but when they go get in the car or whatever, there's a Pinkerton guard that rides with the actresses.
Okay.
And they usually go up to the top of Mulholland Drive to like a parking lot someplace really abandoned. And he gets out, and he's packing and everything. He's looking around and everything. He's got a case. And they take the jewelry off, and they put him in there, you know, after the Oscars or the screening or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he locks it up with a key. It's handcuffed to his arm, and he's got a car waiting for him, and he goes and gets in it and drives away.
That is. I've never thought about that. That is absolutely insane.
Yeah, because you'll see these beautiful women wearing, you know, maybe $2 or $3 million worth of, you know, jewelry to an event.
That's a whole production in and of itself.
But it's alone. It's a loner.
Wow. You learn something new every day, Brian.
Every day.
God damn. Oh, my word.
Unless you were Elizabeth Taylor, you know, and I think Burton bought her those diamonds.
Lucky bitch, you know.
Yeah, or Melania Trump.
Yeah, there's a lot. Well, there's some lucky women out there.
Yeah.
don't have to get that loaner stuff, you know. My word. How are we looking, Alexa? Almost there? We're good to go? Heck yeah. You're man, oh man. Like Alexa's really she's the whole operation here. She's the one who's really doing all the hard work. We have the easy job, you know. We just talk to people like you. Our job is easy.
She's also the cutest.
That's true. You know, hey, Brian's not bad, but I think she wins by, you know, just a small margin. But
Well, you know, it's like I've always said, when it comes, never mind. I won't say it again. I said it too many times. You know, somebody like threatened me one time. They said, you always say that. I'm not going to say it again. But it's like I always said. I'm sure I will.
There you go.
Got a little Jack Daniels. That'll help me say anything.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I don't know what we got.
I actually think we have some Jim Beam up there. If you.
That was actually what Dylan drank was Jim Beam.
Really?
And I.
Did you want some?
Yeah, I'll take a little Jim. That'd be kind of nice. I'm on vacation now. You know that when we were at the Montana studio, I was telling you about that. Dylan had a big bottle of Jim Beam. Whatever, and I was telling you we had done that show in New Orleans with the National Lampoon, and we did the. Now you got to realize I was Ratso Sloman, you know, who wrote Rolling Thunder. You know, knew Bob very well, and New Orleans.
This is what we got here.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
What a selection.
Not the Glenlivet.
It's vanilla. Is that all right with you?
Oh, vanilla.
Well, I guess it'll have to be.
Oh, my God.
I'll pretend.
Brian, what are you doing? Come on.
That's all right.
I didn't buy this. Someone left it at my house.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure, that's what they all say. That's what they all say.
Yeah, Jim Beam Vanilli.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
The old songwriting team of Beam and Vanilli.
They've written a lot of good ones, you know?
They did.
And some not-so-good ones.
Yeah.
Actually, a lot of not-so-good ones. Wait, but that is absolutely crazy. That's wild.
Well, Bob had a fifth of Jim Beam at the Montana studio. And for whatever reason, you know, I kind of kept my mouth shut, but I had hurt my foot when I was down in New Orleans. I cut my foot. It was Halloween.
Okay.
And I was on crutches because I had stitches in my foot. And maybe he felt sorry for me or something, you know, because I was hobbling around on the crutches, but I didn't talk too much.
Mm-hmm.
And he told his girlfriend, Susan, who actually took me up there, Susan Ross. She took Tommy up there, too. And he told Susie, you know, I like him. He can come back, meaning me. He says, I don't think he'll talk like me. You know, like, go tell stories about it, which I'm doing right now.
Yeah, you know, statute of limitations.
That's
that kind
exactly.
Of thing.
Time has passed. You know, it's time. It doesn't
matter.
Wait,
so did you knew Tony then?
Oh, yeah, I knew Tony because Tony... Well, first of all, we had connections because his family's from the Atchafalaya Basin down south in Louisiana. Okay. And he had played with Asleep at the Wheel, and he played with Kenji Freeman at the Lone Star.
Tony is a phenomenal. I think Tony is one of the best musicians on the face of the
earth. Well, absolutely.
He is unbelievable.
And Tony and I were really good. Actually, we were like hangout buddies. You know, we were like really good buddies. And Tony had been doing a show with us with David Johansen, just passed away yesterday. And... he was a great guy, man. It was a great opportunity to work with him in the capacity that I did. It was a show called Buster Poindexter.
Okay.
Buster Poindexter
Show.
Oh, yeah,
you were talking about that earlier.
Which became Buster Poindexter and the Banshees of Blue.
Yes.
So this actually won't open because it hasn't been opened in so long. Do you want a beer? We have beer.
Oh, can I try it?
If you want it.
Beer's not the same, you know.
Someone left this at my house, and it's been sitting on the shelf for like five years.
Beer is for football games.
We'll pass this around. Whiskey is for podcasts. Exactly. We'll just pass it around. If not, we'll just...
Damn, it's more open. Maybe got a pair of pliers?
Yeah, I can give it a shot if you'd like.
Yeah.
Oh, that's rough right there.
My grip is not what it used to be. since I shook hands, you know, with that crazy fellow backstage. What was that boy's name?
That's really on there. There we go.
Oh, you got it. All right.
We're good. He got it on there.
We'll do it like a little shot glass, maybe.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
No, but Tony was one of my votes to get Tony up there because he played upright. He was such a great musician.
Yeah.
And I said, this is the perfect guy to play with Bob. And then later, Susie took him Larry Campbell, who was our other really good friend who played with
Larry's
Tony.
Larry's unbelievable as well, yeah.
You know Larry, right? So we had from Nashville here or
no? I don't know him personally, but just as a fan, I love both those guys,
right?
Yeah.
So you had Larry and Tony, and that was a great combo for Bob
for sure.
And Bob gets tired of things, wants to switch it up a little bit, but I'll tell you what happened was that he hired G.E. Smith, who was from Saturday Night Live, a different era from me. But I always had a nickname for him, you know, and Mastodon Head, because he had the kind of big head, you know. So did Al Franken. I called him Mastodon Head too. But at any rate, I think he's a great musician, but I think he was the right guy to play with Bob.
Yeah.
And they got over, and they were doing tours over there. So Tony comes back from that first leg of the tour, the never-ending tour, you know.
Since
1986.
Yeah, since 1980, yeah. Whatever it was.
That's when it was. It was November of 1986. I can tell you when it was. Montana Studio was there.
There you go.
And I've been there for about a week. I did a lot of fun things that week. tell you about that. But Tony went up, and it was actually the last night I was there, and he had that case and everything. And Susan was really promoting him to Bob, and Bob was kind of like, he had his Ray-Bans on that night. Mm-hmm. So he was kind of grumpy. And but it had been really golden all week long. I mean, just golden.
Yeah.
I saw a person like that that has so much charisma, Bob Dylan, that he's almost like otherworldly. He's almost like a space alien, you know. Mm-hmm. He's not quite the mortals like the rest of us, you know. And at one point when he was really cheerful and happy and was smiling, I swear he started kind of to glow, like he had a glow about him. You know how they say people have an aura? Well, you can almost see it.
Yeah.
And that was fun because when I went up there, he had this hood on. It was an old sweatshirt with a hood, and he had these gloves with the fingers cut out and a scarf tied around his neck. And the next night, he had the same thing on, and the next night. So at one point, yeah, I know that Eric Anderson had felt badly because he had talked to some biographer about him and seen him in a while and wanted to see Bob. You know, I said, well, Eric was a friend. I said, well, come on up. I said, I'm going to take you up there. And he was friends with Susie, too. And I said, I bet he'd love to see you. I said, but before we go, we're going to stop off over here at the Army Surplus Store because I've got an idea. And I had another friend with me, and his name was Miami Dine. Now, he since passed away. He was just a really good friend. But was one of these like ultimate Beatle, not Beatle, but Dylan type fans. You know, he loved Bob Dylan, mm-hmm. and he would always had always bought his records since the first one, and kept one that was wrapped in the cellophane, and didn't open it, and then had one.
Had
to
one
play.
To play, yeah.
Yeah, so he had this great collection, you know, and he was a nice guy and quiet, and I knew he wouldn't be trouble, you know, mm-hmm. and he'd probably enjoy having him up there, you know. So we stopped off at the Army Surplus Store. I think it was on 23rd Street on the way up to the Montana Studio, which is on the Upper West Side. And I just sprung for it because it wasn't expensive. I bought everybody a sweatshirt with a hood and some cheap gloves. You know, we cut the fingers off. I said, just put these on. Don't say anything about it. You do it. All right. I said, they're like, why are we doing this? I said, well, I'll explain later. I said, now let's go over here and let's get a scarf. Let's tie them right here. There you go. Hey, that's good. That's good. See if you can make your hair tough out from under it. There you go. So we walked in, and Bob would like, he was listening, you know, because he was putting together a band. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about what he was wanting to do. And he put his guitar down in the midst of them playing and walk around and listen to them, you know. And then sometimes, generally, like if he had a lot of people up there who were playing with him, he'd order some food and they'd go out into the hallway and eat. And Bob would just hang out inside the studio. And, so when we walked in, he was in there just by himself. And he turned around, and he saw us in those hoods. And, of course, he was wearing his hood, you know. And, you know, I think maybe it might have been like, you know, you have life imitating art, art imitating life. It's not mm-hmm. James. You got somebody imitates their idol, and then the idol gets imitated. You yeah, know, exactly. It reverses. And I think Springsteen had done that record cover with the hood up, you know, and his hands in his pockets, you know, that Born in the USA thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe Dylan was, but it was not the same effect. I mean, when he Dylan yeah. wore the hood, he looked like he'd been wearing it for like many years. And so we walked in there. He turned around and looked at us, you know, and sometimes he wouldn't wear his glasses, and he'd have kind of, he'd be looking like this, you know, and you would think he's like looking hard at you, but he was just trying to see you, yeah. you know? And he's like looking like this and everything. And he said, what? I said, well, Bob, I said, you started a new trend. And when he started laughing when I said that. And he walked over and he saw it was Eric Anderson when he flipped that hood down. Yeah. And he pointed to him because Eric thought he was really mad at him. And he said, I thought you were dead. then he started kind of like picking on him. He said, you know, he said, you got to get your geography straight. And he was talking about Eric had done some interview on NPR that Bob had listened to on his farm in Minnesota.
Okay.
And he had heard it, you know, and Eric had placed, it wasn't the Mississippi, but it was another river somewhere. He had put it in the wrong state, you know, when he was talking about the geography of it.
Yeah.
And Dylan was telling him, man, you got to get your geography straight. And he was telling, you know, this river runs, the James runs through Virginia. It doesn't, it's not in Ohio. You know, he's like, that kind
of thing. thank you.
And then they started reminiscing. And that's what was so much fun about it, because then you got to be like the fly on the wall. And Bob was asking him questions about Ramblin' Jack Elliott. You know,
if I could have anyone at this table besides yourself, obviously, sir, it would be. I think it would be Ramblin' Jack Elliott.
Hey, Jack, come on, man!
So, surprise!
I told you I'd get you on. So at any rate, you want him to wear his hat? So they was asking the questions like that, you know, about Ramblin' Jack Elliott, and did he still have and his hat? Where was his hat? He was just like, and he was reminiscing about old things and old times, you know. And he had this big glowing smile on his face, you know. He just looked so happy. It was a little bit of a sneer, but it was a smile, you know. And he just, man, he really glowed. It was like it was just a magic moment.
As someone who's met, I mean, the amount of people that you've met is just staggering.
It's weird, I know.
Who is there anyone in that ballpark like Bob that has put you in awe in that way?
Oh,
or
yeah, sure.
Is he towards the top?
Of course. I mean, you know, Johnny Cash. I mean, that was just, you know.
That has to be like meeting.
How'd you meet him?
Yeah.
I got to be really good friends with his piano player, Earl Poubal, and we grew up not far from each other in Mississippi. He's older than I am, but we had so many things and coincidences. And we got to be very good friends through a mutual friend of ours, Eddie Betos, who was a keyboard player and was my record producer and really music director and everything with the Timber Sheiks, my band in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And really, a musical soulmate to me, a partner. And he introduced me to Earl. Man, we just hit it off, you know. Loved him. He loved me. And when Johnny at that time was doing a lot of that, he had split from Columbia and kind of flipped them the bird.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did that record. The guy who produced it, you know, he did the hip-hop records. But
Rick Rubin. Yeah.
And like, man.
And,
oh, yeah, Record of the Year, the award, all the Grammys. I mean, Johnny swept it. But he was doing a lot of that, you know, just the guitar and his thumb. And that's all he needed, you know. It was like the kids were coming out and going crazy. He didn't even need his band, you know. And I think the other guys in the band were a little put out, you know, because they were, like, used to being on the road with him all the time, you know. But he was doing this solo stuff quite a bit now. And you couldn't blame him, you know, and they said that too. They said, look, if you can get out there and do it with your thumb and a guitar, why not?
Yeah.
Go for it, buddy. And but when I met him, and I met him through Earl Poubal.
Okay.
His piano player, longtime piano player. And I had a really dear, dear friend, like another soulmate too, is Joy Lauren Adams. I don't know if you know the actress, but she started Chasing Amy and so many films. She Dazed and Confused. It's a little before but you might remember Big Daddy with Adam Sandler, you know.
She's
the mom of the big dove.
Oh, there you go.
Patrick. So at any rate,
hello Joey,
I love you dearly. But Joey, you know, Joey loved Johnny Cash. And when she was a little girl, her parents knew she was going to be different, because they said all the other little girls were swooning over Donny Osmond. But Johnny Cash would come on television, and Joey would get up and go over and kiss the TV set when she was like 3 years old. And she just loved Johnny Cash. So I had arranged with Earl to meet Johnny Cash and introduce him to Joey. And that's how I got to know him.
Wow.
And he was great. He was funny, man. He was a brilliant guy. Just great sense of humor, too. And I mean, in some of his songs and everything, just listening to him, gives me chills to listen to his songs, his voice, and his whole demeanor. And I just heard so many great stories about him, too, and everything that I saw when I was around him. And I wasn't around him all that much, but I've been around him several times. It lived up to it. So he was just awe-inspiring.
Yeah, there are people, I think, Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan, those are two guys that you often hear them when being described as very stoic, not very serious, may not be the right word, but the humor isn't always involved. And I think it's interesting to hear that those guys were very.
I don't know about Dylan, but I know that I know that Johnny Cash was. He appreciated the humor and everything because as he was recounting this sketch one time, you know, at Saturday Night Live when he hosted Saturday Night Live, where they had him, you know, the man in black, and he was doing a dandruff commercial. You know, I have to be careful wearing black all the time. You know, and he's, you know, these snowflakes getting on my shoulders here, and I used to do this thing with a buddy of mine. We did the thing called Cash and the Clown.
Okay.
And he did this kind of like little high voice radio clown named Zippy Jingles. It was a radio show in New York. And I'd do Johnny Cash. So it was like the Adventures, kind of like Dylan and Cash tagging around together. Mm-hmm. But instead it was Johnny Cash and Zippy Jingles. And I just love little old Zippy. He tickles me to death. Thank you, Johnny. Beep, beep, beep. You know? And I know that Dylan and Johnny Cash were very, very close. And Johnny Cash had helped keep Dylan on the Columbia label at the time, you know, when his first record didn't do too well. Because it had a lack of Dylan songs on it, you know. The second one did very well. But he fought to keep him on there. And I think they were close friends and admired each other. And then I know, probably shouldn't tell this, but, you know, I know that I was told that wherever they were in the world at the time, it's before everybody had cell phones, you know, back in those days, that Bob Dylan's number of his hotel and his room, and what you say to get that room number, to talk to them on Johnny's night table, and they talked to each other every night.
Oh, wow.
They were that close.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, like, so for anyone who is listening, you were on Saturday Night Live in the 80s?
I was there season 6, which is considered the worst period of the show. But I'm going to tell you what, after coming back from the 50th get together in New York, the shindig.
Yeah, that was just this past week, right?
A couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Valentine's Day was the concert. I find that there's a certain mystique now to being season 6, you know.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
And,
infamous.
You know what it is. It was so much idolatry of Lorne Michaels at this thing. It's almost like a, you know, it's my party.
So last night we looked up, we were just doing some research on you. We saw the skit where you were playing Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
I'm curious, do you know if he ever saw that?
No, I don't. I really don't know.
It was a very good impression.
I've never mentioned it to him. I had no idea that was me.
That's funny.
I know, but
that's what the costume's for. You know, hide under that.
But yeah. I do know this: that later, after doing that sketch on Saturday Night Live, I worked with Procter and Bergman, you know, from the Firesign Theater.
Okay,
and we did the world's first podcast, the first one.
Wow.
That came from, it was done, I'm going to say this is like 93, and it was at the Hollywood Athletic Club, and it was the first live broadcast via the internet to the satellites that went all around the world live, real time.
Really?
And it was a podcast, and it was called Digital Diner.
Okay.
And I can remember that it was digdig.net. That's how you pulled it up to hear it live.
Interesting.
And we took the Hollywood Athletic Club, and each room was like a different studio. So you had like all these, like, it was almost like a live comedy show, and it was. And one skits were setting up over here, and some of them were like live music and everything. You know, I did a song on the show. But the one thing that I did was a running gag, it was born out of something else I had done with the Firesign Theater, is that I did Bob Dylan and bought the brokerage firm Dylan Reed with Lou Reed. And Dylan Reed was kind of a famous brokerage firm at the time. There was a lot of talk in the press and everything that it was for sale. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I'm Bob Dylan. I just bought the brokerage firm Dylan Reed with my buddy Lou Reed. And I got a tip for everybody with money in the market. You know, so it was that kind of thing. The Fed has just cut the prime rate again. We believe it's just the beginning. And then I do, like, you know, the interest rates, they aren't changing.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
great. The revolving debt of Hattie Carroll, that kind of thing. And Susan thought that this was so funny, you know, so well executed and funny.
Yeah.
And she wanted Bob very much to hear it. So she took a cassette over of all these, like, Dylan Reed things that I'd done. There was a bunch of them. And played it for him. he didn't like it. He said, that person should be killed. And tore the tape up, threw it out the window. Said this. He just did not like it. So anyway, that wasn't me really that did that. That's a phony story. I just made up Bob, and I was just teasing.
So going back to, you're fascinating because you're really a jack of all trades. I mean, you've got the musician element of your life. You've got the sort of comedic element of it. What was your entry point for all of this? One thing I really suck at, though,
is taking selfies. I'm not good at that at all.
Well, I mean, like, we all have our faults.
We have to have a mirror, you know.
What was your entry point? What was the first thing that grabbed your attention as a young person?
Oh, the first thing as a young person creatively was Elvis. And I was a little kid, I was 3 or 4 years old. And my mother had an illness, and my grandmother and my aunt lived in Meridian, Mississippi, which is the hometown of the father country blues, Jimmy Rogers, you know? Mm-hmm. So you had the Jimmy Rogers Day there, which is still an event, but it was really big in the 50s like that. You know, you had Ernest Tubb and, you know, they came and you know.
People don't Marty realize Robbins how big and, he was. I mean, Jimmy Rogers was on another fucking level.
He really was, it's man. I mean, he really started everything. He was before the Carter family, you know? And, they took after him, you know? I mean, he was the yodeling brakeman, man. I mean, he was incredible. And my family was from all up in that area. My mother's side of the family, you know, from Meridian or near Meridian. Mm-hmm. And my aunt and my grandmother had an optical business there. So I was spending time there. My dad was still continuing to work in my hometown of where I was born in Hattiesburg. Mm-hmm. And then he'd take the train up on the weekends, you know, and spend the weekends with me. And my mom was in the hospital for quite a while, but she recovered. And, but needless to say, when I was up there and I was 3 or 4 years old, I got spoiled pretty good. And my grandmother and an aunt, you know, everybody loved Elvis. And, you know, Elvis is like the Mississippi Jesus. You know, if you're from Mississippi, you love Elvis. If you don't, then you're considered an anti-Elvis. Yeah. and so I just, like, from the minute, like, I first saw him on TV and my babysitter, you know, she was a very nice girl, but she was a teenager. And sometimes when she was babysitting me at night, she'd sneak me out with her boyfriend and take me to the movies with him. Mm-hmm. So I got to see those Elvis movies.
Oh, nice.
And, man, I came out of there. That's all I wanted to do was play guitar and be Elvis. And Mr. Peavy's Music in Meridian, my grandmother bought me my first, like, real guitar, very similar to that one over there. It was a Stella. Mm-hmm. And it was the 50s style with the blonde, you know, and the Palomino color.
Yeah, yeah.
And plywood. But
only the finest.
She bought me that guitar and, you know, from Mr. Peavy when I was 4 years old.
Okay.
And that was it. That was the beginning for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my aunt used to say, you know, you're just going to be a guitar picker, you know. They really regretted buying it for me after the years rolled by. They had hoped I had done something else, you know, a doctor, a lawyer, or something a little bit more respectable.
We can all sympathize with that, I'm sure. Yeah.
So how long until when you, you know, first picked a guitar up and started playing until you kind of, because you've played in a lot of bands, right? I saw you played with, like, the Meters, is that true?
Well, the Meters were a band, and I played with them, like, as my act. Like opening for them and that sort of thing. I didn't play the actual band. But Zig Bartolista of the Meters, the drummer, he plays on the record that you like, The Queen of Tupelo, also on Hound Dog Diaries on some of the tracks.
That's fantastic.
He played on The Queen of Tupelo. He played on House Party, Watching Marita. Mm-hmm. That's Zig.
That's amazing.
Playing from the Meters. And I'm still really good friends with him. I mean, I love him. Joseph Bartolista.
That's
He's
amazing.
The best drummer in the world.
So like, what? When did you start to, you know, finally play gigs and stuff like that?
Well,
how'd you get started?
Well,
I'll
tell you. You know, I started just really when I was in elementary school, taking my guitar to school and playing for, like, you know, events and things at school. You know, chapel. You know, that kind of thing. I'd play at the church. You know, like Bible school. I'd take the guitar and play, and teachers would have me up sometimes in front of the class in elementary school and show and tell and let me play some songs. And I started writing songs. First one I remember writing, I was like 10 years old. And it was about a horse named Blue. I know there's a mention in a song later, but this was really a song that I'd written called Old Blue that preceded that by decades. And He was the oldest horse in town. Is that what? Okay. That was kind of the hit in the song. Yeah, he was a really old horse, and he was the oldest horse in town. You know, and never put him down. And he's the oldest horse in town. And that was 10.
That's
then
amazing.
I drew a crayon picture of a horse.
Nice. You know?
And I remember writing it, and I couldn't really play the whole chord, but I played like kind of ukulele chords, you know? And it was like C and G7, you know, C and G7.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was two fingers, you know?
Yeah.
And I wrote that little song, could sing it, you know, and that was the first one I wrote.
That's amazing. It is. There's nothing like when that gets under your skin.
Yeah.
And you just.
Never goes away.
Yeah, never, never. It only gets worse as time, as time goes on. So I'm curious just to kind of backtrack a second to a little bit of what we were talking about earlier. How did the SNL thing even occur? How did that happen?
That was carelessness. I mean, it was just, you know, should have been avoided. No, it was what happened was this. I had gone to New York and I had kind of, you know, putted around, you know, the old, again, Dylan, you know, the only thing I did wrong, stayed in Mississippi a day too long.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I kind of like stayed down because things got comfortable. I moved to New Orleans. I was having a really good time playing in New Orleans with my friends down there and was having, New Orleans is just a great place to live. You know what I mean? Yeah, hard to leave it. And I was only like, you know, like 23, 22. I did go to school. I graduated from the University of Southern Mississippi in fine arts. And I had a big sprawling around the airplane when I was in college. You know, I played a lot, just everywhere. I played all over. Every joint you could play in the college town, I'd go and play at Ole Miss. I'd play down on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. I'd play places in New Orleans. You know, I was just like all over the place. You know, like anywhere I went, I played.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, and I'd get paying gigs. I'd play open mics until I got paying gigs. You know, I just played. Went to the Ice House when I was 18 in California and played out there in Pasadena and all around L.A. and then went back to go to school. That was right after graduating from high school. Had cousins lived out in Seattle. I'd go out there and play all over Seattle. I played up in Vancouver. You know, in that area up there, Oil Can Harry's, the DMZ in Seattle, the Blue Moon, all that stuff when I was like, you know, 15, 16 years old.
So at this point, the focus was all music, or was there any kind of comedic?
The comedic part came about because sometimes you get in there and you're just a single guy playing or whatever, and you might get some drunks out there, and they're talking, and they don't want to listen to you, and they're loud, you know, and you might just walk into the whole crowd, like, you know. And if you've got a band, you can kind of just, you know, kick it up and jump over that.
Yeah.
But if you're just playing.
If it's just you, yeah.
If it's just you, it's tough to win them over. So I'd always find something that was real crazy to throw out there that they wouldn't expect. You know, and that
that's
kinda,
you just described my entire repertoire of songwriting.
Right. So I'd always, like, come up with something that was, an ear catcher.
Yeah.
Like
grab their attention.
I'd break into Heartbreak Hotel. And, you know, I played Elvis, like, you know, twice on Broadway.
Okay.
And I played Elvis also in a non-singing role one time with in a show that Sandy Bullock produced. Sandra Bullock, and that was at theater in L.A. called Velvet Elvis. But I was Elvis, an American musical, and I was in a show called Rock and Roll: The First 5,000 Years at the St. James Theater, in which I played Levon Helm, as a matter of fact, in the band. I played Bob Dylan, I played Elvis, I played Brian Jones and the Rolling Stones. I played the whole plot.
We're going to keep going all over the place, but I want to go back to what you were saying before we sat down here talking about Levon and the boys. How did you meet those various gentlemen?
Here's what happened was that I was doing the show I was telling you about. This was Rock and Roll the First 5,000 Years.
Okay.
And this was one of those, like, 5,000 years of history and I think probably $5,000 of cocaine ideas. Because at the time, the 30-year history of rock and roll juxtaposed and images and visions from songs and everything to parallel the 5,000-year history of Western civilization dating back to Sumerian Egypt.
That is a great fucking idea.
Yeah. And along as well as the past 30-year social history of America.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really wonderful because it started out, you know, like Sinatra, a recording of Sinatra doing Love is Many Splendid Thing. And this guy was so great, man. He's passed away now, but Carl Weaver did this incredible Little Richard. You know, riding a Little Richard, you know, taking focus. And so it ran through several acts and everything. Then the dramatic pause and the lights come up, you know.
Yeah.
It's me. It's Elvis. And that was something, you know. So that was the show. And John Simon was the music director who had produced the Brown album and Stage, you know, all the band records, mm-hmm. Music from Big Pink, everything. And of course, you know, and they had broken up by then, but he did the last waltz, you know. And then Bones Malone, who was at Saturday Night Live and is from Mississippi, too. I knew his sister really well in college, Annie. And he did the horn arrangements and everything for that. Mm. And for
the last waltz?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the Blues Brothers, too.
Oh, you know. One of my favorite movies right so, there.
It's a good one.
So at any rate, the what happened was that we started talking and we were going out to lunch together and everything, you know, and he was saying, well, Patrick, you know, we heard you were a prima donna from Saturday Night Live, but it's not true, and we're really glad we hired you. And yeah, it's like a little personal insights. And and we got to be really good friends. In fact, I was just, you know, he had produced Simon and Garfunkel. He had produced, you know, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Janis Joplin. Mm. Jefferson Airplane, mm-hmm. just any you think of it in the 60s, and yeah, he produced
that,
it.
That era, he was just, he his was hands it. Were all he was over it. Yeah.
And so I, just as a getaway, I went out with my girlfriend to upstate New York just to go up to the Catskills and everything. What's the thing about going up there to see Bob Dylan's house or anything, you know? She didn't bear the fascination with the music as much as I did, I've got to tell you. Mm-hmm. So we went up there, and it was... It was my girlfriend and her sister. They were beautiful, lovely girls, very bright and engaging. And we went to a little diner, a little restaurant called Deanie's. And we're staying at this place called the Twin Gables, which is like a, you know, bed and breakfast type thing. And we went to Deanie's, like late night, to get a drink. And there's Rick Danko and Paul Butterfield at a table over there. And it was one other guy, and I've forgotten who it was that was with them. But we went over and sat down, you know, and they invited us over. And we started talking with them, and they were just great. And, you know, and Paul Butterfield's a little, like, you know, condescending, like, so you want to see Bob Dylan's house? I'm on your head. No, not really, but, you know, I mean, now like, that you mention it, you know. And so we just, and then we started that, told him I was doing the show I was doing. I played Levon in the show during the night they drove Old Dixie down. Yeah. Like, wow, you know. And I said I played Bob in it, you know, and, you know, and Rick would say something, things like, well, I think Bob's changed, but he hadn't changed, man. I love Bob. Was, they were just nice guys. And, at the time, Levon had just done The Right Stuff, so he wasn't there.
Okay.
But Butterfield had met, like, a lot of the people in The Right Stuff and everything, so he said, you know, he said, you remind me of Tommy Lee Jones. He said, that's not a compliment. That was actually from the coal miner's daughter, if you remember. And so at any rate, that was how that kind of happened. And so Rick gave me his phone number to give to John Simon, tell him to call him. So I said, hey, man, I ran into Rick Danko. And he's like, yeah, right. You yeah. know? And he wants you to call him. Sure. And he did. Patrick, thank you. He said, that was so great to hook me back up with Rick.
Yeah.
And then I ended up going to the Long Star by invitation to see Rick and Levon play there doing a duet.
Oh, yeah, yeah, they did the duet there.
And so we were hanging out. Rick's, come on backstage, you know. So I went up there, and I was out in the crowd drinking. I was a little toasted. I was, yeah, okay. And I'd had a few cocktails, you know, shots at the bar, you know, with my buddies. So I got up there, and they were trying to work up the second set of what they should do. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to, like, help them out. and Levon kept saying, you're too drunk, man. So I said, I'm doing that, they drove Old Dixie down. And Levon said, man, it's too hard to sing, you know? Because, I mean,
yeah.
It's the mandolin and the guitar. And I meant to say Ophelia, but I said Elvira. And so, I mean, it really, you know, what an embarrassing thing. You know, I still think about it. You know, and even now that they've all passed, it still haunts me, you know. And Levon looked at me and he said, see what I mean? Because he knew that I didn't mean. He's real smart. He knew I didn't mean Elvira. He knew that I meant Ophelia.
Yeah.
But I was drunk and I said Elvira.
I cannot imagine being in the same room as those two men. That's gotta be
wild. Fabulous. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, and just, you know, knew them and met all the band, you know, including Richard Manuel, you know, at different times. I met all the band, Nick's Robbie, you know, because they played the Lone Star, and I went down, invited again, you know, and the whole band was there, except him.
Wow.
And I met them all, Garth, you know, all of them.
So yeah, we were just talking. Who do we have on? We had Moe's on, and we were talking about Garth when he passed. That was a real shame. Garth, I mean, I love all of those guys, but he was the glue. He was the thing that just
that's what
kept
Bob
it all.
Dylan said.
Really?
Yeah.
There you go.
He issued a statement said he was really the driving force behind the band.
Yeah. I mean, again, love all those guys to death, but Garth was just another level.
Well, I have a friend too, and her father United States congressman, mm-hmm. House of Representative, but he was really good friends with Levon.
Okay.
They had kind of grown up together, whatever, and all that. You know, he'd pick Levon up at the airport when he was coming in, you know, and take him back to the airport. He was going back to go on the road. And he had a club down in New Orleans for a while. And I had friends that worked with him on that club. You know, so I had, you know, exchanges and things with Levon, like, over the years. And, but that was really a lot of fun working on that show where you played like so many different rock acts and you got to meet people. Got to meet David Bowie and all that kind of business.
What was your relationship to New Orleans? How did all of that
Orleans is not far from where I was born in Hattiesburg. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that. It's the only big city nearby.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like the backyard. If you're from South Mississippi or the Gulf Coast area, New Orleans is kind of like your backyard. I mean, New Orleans is closer to Mississippi than it is to Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
You know. So it's just right across the Pontchartrain, you know.
What was the, when you first got there, what was that era of music like in that scene?
In New Orleans?
In New Orleans, yeah.
Well, it was, you know, you had the 70s funk, which was incredible. You know, you had the Meters and... you know, Mama Coco, you had all these different acts there. And, of course, you had Alan Toussaint doing a lot of, as he had been in the 62, you know, mm-hmm. writing and producing. And I know the Meters, you know, Zig played on the Lee Dorsey song, Working in the Coal Mine, written by Alan Toussaint, produced by him, you know, working in the coal mine, going down, 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 doom, 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 doom. That's, you know, Zig and Leo and George from the original Meters, you know. They were 14 years old.
Damn.
So they had mixed emotions about that, now getting $20 and shuffled in and out the back door and playing on hit records when they were young teens. They later became, you know, Professor Longhair's backup band, so they had the Fessels playing then. So the music scene in the 70s was really sparkling in New Orleans, man. It was never hotter. Dr. John, I mean, it was just great. Fantastic.
I love Dr. John, yeah.
Etta James, you know, just the whole thing down there was fantastic. And you had disco going on at other places, you know, which wasn't my favorite genre.
Yeah, I was
going
to ask, how did that manifest in a place like New Orleans? Because I would almost imagine that it kind of just passed it by. How did that go?
New Orleans was deep-seated, I think, in its creation. New Orleans had the world's first disco theater.
Really?
That they based Studio 54 on. Because I worked at Studio 54. Mm-hmm. And Ian Schrager and Steve Rebell had gone down and seen the Civic, mm-hmm. the Civic Dance Theater, or Civic Auditorium, disco, Civic Disco in New Orleans, and had been the old Civic Theater, and they had turned it into a discotheque with the batons flying things in and out, you know, mm-hmm. infamously. And at Studio, it was the moon, you know, with a spoon. And down there, all kinds of things. They fly in and out, fleur-de-lis and things, and they fly a girl down, you know, in a diaper like Cupid, you know, with the bow and arrow, you know, coming from. So using all the batons and everything, you know, and the rod, you know, mm-hmm. from the theater element of it to make it, you know, a club event.
Damn. I'm always really...
So Studio was based upon the Civic Auditorium, the Civic Disco in New Orleans.
I'm learning all kinds of shit today. I had no idea.
Yeah.
So when was the first time... Because now my understanding is your material, you do everything. I mean, you record everything, you track all the instruments, you do the mixing, you do the mastering, which is, I mean, that's unbelievable. When was that always the case? Were you always so hands-on with it? Or is that something that's happened as times progressed?
No. But I tell you what I did have that was an advantage is that when I was a kid, mm-hmm. my parents, you know, got a little tape recorder for me. Mm-hmm. I started recording with it, and it was actually a tape recorder that was bought to like record messages on and send to family members.
Yeah.
But I started recording on it. I said, well, you know, he's enjoying this. Let's get him a better one. And they got one that was a stereo. So it had like, yeah. you know, two channels to it, and you could put a guitar over here. And then I found out that you could overdub, meaning like he'd lose some quality underneath, but you could record another guitar on top of that guitar
okay.
or a vocal on top of that vocal. So I started doing that till eventually, when I got a little older, they bought me a TIAC 4-track. My grandmother did. So I had 4 tracks now to work on, and it was sound on sound, so you could bounce 3 over to 1. And
yeah.
So, you know, the Beatles, I think the Beatles had done Sergeant Pepper on that.
Yeah.
On 2 of those, you know?
Mm-hmm. So that's unbelievable to think about the way that they got. I mean, I think the same thing about some other, like Pink Floyd records, for example.
Yeah.
Just the way that they got some of those sounds boggles my mind to think of what they were working with.
Really? You know?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I say that, you know, so I had a lot of practice. You know, I could write a song. I found out I could do harmonies with myself. And
yeah.
I'd do things like, I'd record like Elvis singing This Old House, you know, and, you know, got to move to a better home. And I'd do the Jordan Ayers backups about him. You know, I'd do all the parts. And it would come out sounding good, you know. Yeah. And I thought, wow, this is kind of cool, you know. And I did some things like that. I had a lot of tapes from that era, and they, you know, they got eaten up in a fire where they were stored out at some family in Seattle, you know. And other ones just over time,
they just go away,
and they weren't transferred properly or anything. And what they were transferred, some of them do, was like the old cassette style tapes, you know, from the reel to reel, and they went away too. There's no sound there anymore.
Mm. Yeah. So when was the first time you actually went into a studio and cut your material?
I think I was 14, 15 years old. And we had played, I had a band at the time, and these guys were all kind of in high school, but I was in junior high. Mm-hmm. But it was my band, at least I thought it was, until they all quit. But, no, we were playing for a show over in Mobile, Alabama.
Okay.
And it was, coincidentally, it was like Labor Day or whatever, and it was also Woodstock. So I can't remember if I was 14 or 15 when we played that, but that was about it. And I had written some original songs. And there was a guy there who had a recording studio in Mobile, and he liked the idea that we were all so young, like the band and everything. And so he set up recording time and brought us over and did some demo recordings in his studio. We went back down to Mobile, and he recorded the whole band and all original material.
What was that like to hear yourself back for the first time in that way, in that fidelity?
It was great. Yeah. You know, it was thrilling. It was exciting, you know, like, wow, you know.
Yeah, you feel like and you're doing it. You feel like you're doing it.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, you know, it was like, you know, I started feeling like, you know, maybe this I could have a career doing this. Mm-hmm. I was excited about it.
I wanted
to run away from home. I wanted to quit high school. I didn't want to go to school, quit junior high.
Yeah, there you go.
When was the moment where you decided that, like, okay, this is like what I want to do for a living? Like, was there, you know, did you even think about it that much? Did you just keep doing it until it just kept working out for you?
Well, I realized when I couldn't do it for a living anymore. You know, I had to find something else, you know, to kind of supplement things, you know, touring and everything with a record that was doing pretty well. And if, you know, you got a down night, you know, there's a storm or something and the clubs will wash out, you still got to pay your boys. You still got to pay the hotel. You still got to do everything. You know?
Yeah, totally.
And that's the reason, you know, you end up sleeping on a girlfriend's couch.
Again, we can all sympathize. We've all been there. You know?
with her rescued greyhound.
Yes.
She was a beautiful dog, by the way. She was very large. And she adored me. And the motif was, I think it was Danish modern. So that love seat was not comfortable at all.
So how long were you, like, touring for?
I started doing it. And, like, you asked me about Saturday Night Live. I don't think I ever got around to how that happened. But
We'll get there.
And, but... You know, I went to New York, so I finished school and really did well playing in school. I was making pretty good money, you know, and particularly when I played a solo act, you know, and keep the door. Yeah. And so I had a lot of places like that where I could play around and did well. And then, went to New York. Should have come here probably to Nashville, but I went to New York and kind of followed that to be, a singer-songwriter. And pretty much it was a lot of disco there at the time. But you had the punk thing was starting to happen. And that whole, new wave,
and
the second British invasion, that kind of stuff with the Police and all that. And you had a lot of bands coming up there, too, that would be, kind of the breath of fresh air in the 80s, like the B-52s and the Talking Heads and Blondie,
Yeah.
And so when I got to New York, I had an old friend that I had been in theater with at University of Southern Mississippi. And he had decided he wanted to leave school and just go to New York and be an actor. So I had directed him in a one-act play of Hotel Baltimore. So I coached him and directed him a bit so he could have an audition piece for the Circle and Square Repertory Company. He got in. So he felt like he kind of owed me a flavor. And I got there. They had a little party for me. My buddies worked at the Irish bar, famous Irish bar over in the theater district called Jimmy Ray's, and he was there, and he said, I got to get a gig of some kind, like a day job or something. And I said, no, come over with me to Studio 54 tomorrow afternoon. He said, people line up around the block want to work there. He says, you make a ton of money. And I'll introduce you to Steve Rebell. So I went over there fresh in from Mississippi and met everybody, and when I walked into that place, I didn't see it at night with all the lights. I saw it in the afternoon when they were cleaning it up with all the bright lights on and, all the stuff stuck to the floor. And he came over and he said, okay, all right. So I was going to trail him and train with him the next night. And I walked in there and he just threw his towel at me. And he said, I've had it here. I'm going to Europe. It's yours. So I got thrown into it.
Oh, that's an interesting way to get a job.
Yeah.
And, that was my introduction. I moved to New York. I went over there, the next day. And the next night, I started Studio 54.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do over there primarily?
Well, I was the men's room attendant. Now, I know that sounds funny, but the truth is there was no type of janitorial work you had to do.
Okay.
What you did is you laid out the concession. So you had some Halston cologne, you had some Dunhill cigarettes. They smoked those at the time, You brought maybe an orchid, like a little flower arrangement, And you just like breath mints and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you're talking about these were a bunch of rich, image-conscious people.
Yeah.
And if they see something like that, they're compelled to tip. And then the next one wants to tip even more, that sort of thing. And it was like the money just stacked out. And I walk out of there at night. My jeans were just filled with money. Nice. I had so much money. And it was just like, I didn't have a bank account. And I go back down to the Hotel Earl where I was roommating with my friend down there. We were writing songs and everything. Mm-hmm. And I just had, there was an old chest of drawers in there, and I just throw the money into those drawers. They were just full of money all the time. And you'd have buddies who'd go, man, can I borrow $20? So, yeah, just take it out of the top drawer. It was that kind of thing. It was crazy. And
that's awesome.
And, of course, then talk about like opening doors. I mean, there you are at Studio 54, you meet everybody in the world.
Totally.
So what was the connective tissue between that and landing the SNL gig?
Well, what happened there was, I was still in the village, pursuing my songwriting career, and probably the wrong town at the wrong time. I mean, Nashville would have been the better choice, but I didn't do that. And, so I met these agents who took a liking to me, and I had been working with a guy named Corey Hay, who was the inside reporter for the National Enquirer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd get so much money for every story I sold the National Enquirer. I was the secret source at Studio 54, right? And so I got to be friends with them. So I compiled all these stories and the outtakes and everything and started writing a book called Studio, A View from the Men's Room, because it was the only place that had a window. Mm-hmm. So if you went in there, you wanted to get some fresh air or whatever, you went in there and you looked out the window, it looked on the back of Roseland. Otherwise, you were in the concrete womb of a secret government,
Yeah.
And so started writing that book, and it brought me one person that I interviewed with was a guy named Ferris Bohaffa. And Ferris Bohaffa became later the head of the Arab League, but he was the manager of some prominent singers down in the quarter, down the quarter, down the village at that time.
Okay.
Singer-songwriters. He was a music guy. Mm-hmm. And he introduced me to the folks over at APA, Agency for the Performing Arts, and they handled variety, which meant that they handled the Blues Brothers, they handled Steve Martin, they handled all these Saturday Night Live people. Mm-hmm. And it was the year that they were replacing the original group. Mm-hmm. And they said, look, it's a chance in the million, but, you know, to want to be a singer-songwriter, we think you're a funny guy. And you tell these stories and these impressions, why don't you go for it? They were going to set me up an audition and everything. Well, they lied. They didn't do that. They gave me a phone number to call Audrey Pert Dickman, who was the casting coordinator, the associate producer, been there forever since day one. Mm-hmm. And she's a British lady, very fine, Audrey Pert Dickman. So I called her, and they said, don't take no for an answer. That's what I did. And they told me it was already cast. I said, no, it's not. I said, you know, you need to see me. So I started doing Rhett Butler, just, you know, anything I could think of, yeah. Jimmy Carter. You know, I was doing all these impressions on the telephone. I just switched from voice to voice to voice as I was talking to her. And finally she said, can you be here at 4:30 this afternoon? And I went down and took my guitar and opened with the Bob Dylan and Johnny Cash duet, where I was like Johnny Cash and C, there's Bob Dylan in A. And I modulate in those keys and voices and also in the persona, mm-hmm. you know, as I was entertaining. And that kind of, that sealed the deal, I think, you know.
I know that era was short-lived for you, but what was that? What was that like? What was the day-to-day of working on that? Well, working on that machine like for you?
I tell you what, it was like, I think the first show that we did, which I wasn't involved in other than I co-wrote the cold opening, mm-hmm. which was that, you know, Live from New York Saturday night. I wrote that whole sketch with a friend that I'd helped to get a job there, but he had come to work there, you know, he's a great writer, and eventually became head writer at the show. But we wrote that cold opening together, and that's something they've been gunning to do since the middle of the summer. And bingo. I mean, it was a fantastic, I thought a great show. It got panned by the critics, but they were lying for it to pan it anyway. You know, it's a woman producer. Who does she think she is taking over after Lauren Michaels and that sort of thing? Mm-hmm. She has no experience in comedy. She's a music producer. You know, she. And I think that they kind of had pre-written a negative.
Yeah, and also after the old guard had already left, I'm sure that there was sort of a gnashing of teeth.
And the sketch that I wrote went after, cut them to the knees. I went right after them. And I love them all. And I got to be very good friends. But I said, that's exactly what they would do if it was she was on the other foot. So let's go for it. And they were like, they couldn't believe that they were making fun of drug use. You know? But it wasn't limited to Saturday Night Live. Well, in our sketch, everybody was using drugs on the Today Show, the news, Gene Shalit, you know, Tom Snyder. How do you think he stays up so late? You know, so, and it was funny. And it was a takeoff because at that time, you know, they talk about who's hosted the show most. You know, I guess it's Steve Martin, I guess. But at that time, it was Elliot Gould.
Really?
So Elliot Gould was doing the show. So we did the sketch like Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. I don't know if you know this movie, but it was a hip movie at the time. It was about these couples who swap. Mm-hmm. And it was Elliot Gould and what was the guy's name? He was an actor. He did I Spy with Bill Cosby, you know, for years on TV. And then there was Natalie Wood. And, gosh, I can't think of her name, but she was a bombshell, too. Blonde Carol and Noel. But anyway, they're in bed with the entire new cast. And everybody's naked in the bed together and on drugs. And obviously just had an orgy. And he's laying there in bed with them. You know, and they're like, oh, hi, Mr. Gould. Remember me from last night? And I'm kind of a cross between Chevy Chase and Bill Murray. Because that's what they were going to say in the press, you know. So I'm kind of a cross between Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray, or mm-hmm. I'm kind of a cross between Gilda and Lorraine, remember me? And so they'd ask questions. What was it like on Saturday Night Live with the original cast? I love them. Did they really use drugs? Mm-hmm. And he was like, oh, yeah, you know. But not just them, but I mean the cameramen, the pages, the interns, everybody used drugs. In fact, the other guys would come up and deliver a sandwich, you know, and John Belushi would tackle them, hold them down, you know, while Dan Aykroyd just shoved coke up their nose. They'd get so stoned they couldn't even deliver their sandwiches. And, you know, wow. You know, so it was like way over the top.
Yeah. Sounds like a wild time.
Yeah. And you know, it was like, Tom Snyder, don't tell me he uses drugs. How the hell do you think he stays up so late, you know? So it was a play on, it was a big, over the top joke. Nobody should have been offended by it.
Yeah. And it's also, you know what you're watching. You're watching SNL.
Like, exactly.
What, like, what are you expecting?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was funny. And I thought many of the other sketches that were deemed politically incorrect at the time were unfunny. I mean, were funny. And I think that they became unfunny once they allowed the curse of, you know, political correctness to seep in. Because it's just really an academic form of censorship.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's as prevalent now as always, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, who's to say what's politically correct and what's not?
It's humor, too. Yeah, with humor, too. I mean, humor is... It either makes, if it makes you laugh, it's done its job.
I agree.
True.
I agree.
So after that, after the SNL era ends for you, how did you pivot? How did you pivot out of that? And did you go straight back to focusing on music? How did that moment of your life go?
Well, what happened next was I had a couple of other opportunities, and it was music. It was not in the way that I, you know, as a songwriter, I'd hoped, but I did a lot of impressions, you know, so I ended up doing Rock and Roll the First 5,000 Years.
Oh, so that was right after that, gotcha.
Yeah, not long after that, yeah. And just other things, you know, other things came along. I ended up doing comedy, too, writing for National Lampoon magazine, you know, as one of the regular contributing editors.
Nice.
And I ended up getting a featured role on a short-lived show that was actually produced by Lorne Michaels called The New Show.
Oh, there you go.
With Buck Henry and Dave Thomas. They didn't really take it as seriously. They didn't get into it as much as they should have, you know, and took it for granted. I think a lot of people were partying and stuff. And it just, it didn't last long. It was like 5 weeks in a best of, you know.
When you're writing... At this point in your life, how do you go about your songwriting process? Has it stayed the same throughout the course of your life, or has it shifted?
I think it stayed the same. I mean, I'll get an idea for a song, and it'll just start dancing in my head, and I'll hear the melody and the words and everything. And if I'm smart and not too lazy or not too distracted, I write it. I go write it down, and I pick up a guitar, and if I can possibly, I'll record at least part of it so I save the melody. Mm-hmm. But I'll write it. I'll sit down and write the chords out, chart them, you know, and put the lyrics down. Maybe not finish it, but get it to a certain point to where there's a structure
Something there. There's a bit of a spark that you can kindle later.
Correct. You know, and that's just the way it is. You know,
who are some songwriters that you love?
Oh gosh, all kinds of songwriters. I like Jimmy Webb, love like Galveston. Oh my God, you know, the Wichita Lineman. It's hard to write a better song than that. Yeah. You know, Bob Dylan. Yeah, love Bob Dylan. I like some of the Lennon and McCartney things, you know, that they did, particularly around the Rubber Soul era.
That's kind of that can be the sweet spot. I mean, I love all the Beatles, but that's kind of the sweet spot.
I think so too. That and Revolver. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I like some of the early Beatles stuff too. It won't be long. As God, you can't do that. Some of you got to write better R&B songs than those.
It's funny. So I'm my day
and
job.
I love the R&B writers. I mean, there's so many different Smokey Robinson. I mean, I love how many so many different songwriters. Little Richard.
Yeah. Oh, Little Richard is a
You know, I mean, Little Richard, Chuck Berry.
Chuck Berry is one of the greatest songwriters that's ever walked
Chuck
the face
Berry,
of this earth.
I always listened to when I was a kid, and probably is one of the biggest influences on me because he had great story songs.
Yeah.
And they were so witty. And they took such great turns and everything. And I'll tell you, I just loved his guitar playing too, and his singing.
Yeah, he is on another level.
Yeah,
My day job is I'm a middle school music teacher, and I was just this past week, I was showing the kids how to make charts for songs, that kind of thing. And I was using some early Beatles, like I was using some early Beatles songs as examples. So we were going through them, charting them out, and just there's so many weird things in those songs that you think, God damn, like they're so
deceptively complicated.
Yeah. And I mean, they're not, you listen to it. I think this is just good songwriting. You listen to it and it doesn't sound out of place in any way, shape or form. Well, but when you go to put pen to paper, you're like, oh my God, there's some weird stuff happening.
Totally.
I tell you, I don't know, you know, how the podcast works, you know, if you're going to play any like cuts from my records or anything, but from my new record, which is, No End of the End, which is, I'm hoping to get out, you know, either by, Jazz Fest is the plan, but unless I do it St. Patrick's Day, which will be very soon.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I might do that. But I'm, you know, as you said, it's a do-it-yourself album. So I played everything on it, did all the vocals, wrote all the music, arranged it.
It sounds fantastic.
Engineered it, recorded it myself. And you talk about, because a couple of them, I really tackled trying to do, like, sound, have a Beatles sound with it, like an early Beatles sound, when they were really a band playing live. I did that with I Don't Like Her Anymore. And the other one was Lock Her Up. And let's see. And so there was definitely, on this record, more than anything I've ever done, had kind of a Beatles flavor to it on some of it, not all of it, but a few of them, enough peppered through there. I even did a sound design, like the John Lennon thing with Revolution Number 9.
Oh, yeah.
I did one called Insurrection 5/4 Time. They played, you know, with Ringo in 5/4 Time, Love Me Do, and they were always said to have, they played 5/4 Time, which wasn't really true.
Yeah.
It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know? And so it's like, so I had that kind of ran through it, and it was like 4, 5, 4, 5, and it was kind of a political thing, like 45 and 4, 5.
Yeah.
And just real, you know, on that record, I noticed when I was writing those songs and I was playing a 360, you know, 330 Rickenbacker guitar like John Lennon, I was a 320 whatever, and I was playing the 360 12 string like George, the way that they would kind of do almost harmony chords, they play like fragments of chords that played together, that worked together, that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
And almost really impossible to duplicate unless you knew what they were doing exactly.
Yeah, there's some great interplay between those guitars. Like, really,
like the way they played together was amazing.
And I think that's
and the bass too.
Oh yeah, and the bass lines is so melodic, but never like the thing about Paul's playing, which I just find staggering. It's so melodic, and yet at the same time, it fills the role that needs to be filled by the bass. And a lot of times when people try and do that melodic, almost counter melody type lines on the bass, it's like the role of the bass isn't being filled, and somehow he could do it all.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, that's, yeah, but as, I mean, it sounds silly saying this about a Beatle, but I think his bass playing in that band is just vastly underrated, because it is unbelievable how well it glues everything together.
I mean, you know, it's, I mean, somebody is so great like that all the time. You know, people get tired of complimenting
them. Yeah, it's true. No, it's true.
Think of dirty things to say.
And that's what I can't imagine being someone like Johnny Cash, like Bob Dylan, like those people for whom we think so highly of musically. Like, that has to be a strange curse to go through life and everyone saying, like, oh, my God, Johnny Cash, I love your songs.
And we leave out people like Carl Perkins. I mean, you can't think of everybody to say. You know what I mean? So it's hard when they ask you, what songwriter do you like? There's so many that influence me vastly. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Rogers, Hank Williams.
Yeah.
Johnny Cash. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Sure.
Yeah, there's so many great ones, and there's fantastic songwriters out there now. That's been one of the joys of doing this, is we've gotten to meet a lot of great people, and also talk to a lot of friends, good friends and peripheral friends, and it's just been great.
You hear that, guys? So if y'all come on the show, make sure you got a good copyright on your music and you got the publishing locked up.
I gotta say, like,
they've got these other songwriters in here. I know about them. I've ever been around them. Yep. Well, I wrote that. No, you didn't. Bruce Springsteen. Never
mind. I'm curious. We originally met you because, or Alexa was going to film an audition thing for you.
That's right.
What were you auditioning for?
You know what?
Just out of curiosity.
So it was a film. A motion picture. I mean, I still do acting from time to time. Not as much as I had been doing, because Louisiana ran the film industry out of Louisiana. You know, the politicians did. Because the film industry is a bunch of gypsies, and they're not going to play by the rules, and they're not going to pay taxes. And if they,
well, it's the music industry, too. So. Yeah.
And they'll just move to the next state, you know, wherever they've got some cloudy days, yeah. You know, and they get super hills in behind them. So, you know, but this looks like a pretty good project, and it came to me. It's the first audition I've had in a long time. But I looked at it, I thought, well, man, I'm really perfect for this, you mm-hmm. know. But it was a demanding audition. They wanted you not just to, like, read for the part, but then to improvise it, you know, twice.
Wow.
Two different improvisations and submit them with different slates. And I mean, it's an oral slate where you talk about they want to make sure that you can be hired as a local hire because they don't want to pay any per diem, you know, if you live 30 minutes over the state line. But they are shooting this one, you know, at my home, so there's no problem with that.
Oh, there you go. Well, fantastic.
So, but it was an interesting thing, and I can tell you a little bit about the role. The role was a minister.
Okay.
And he had been, I think, prior to that, a professional boxer, mm-hmm. and many moons ago. And he's telling the story about when he had won the third ever technical knockout in a mm-hmm. fight. And I had been hammered by this kid who was 20 years, almost 20 years younger than him. And he goes down, he's, you know, beat down to the ground. And he was getting one count, but hearing another. And so he was saying that, you know, that was the grace of God. It was grace holding back that bell until you're ready to stand up again. So I kind of have a feeling this movie might have a religious subtext.
Mm-hmm. They don't tell you, like, the full...
No, they
what
didn't,
the movie's about or anything.
They didn't ask me that, like a girl's, okay. like, you know, like a Catholic girl's family. No, they didn't ask me that.
When you find out, let us know, because we're curious.
I sure will.
Yeah. I just told him. I hope you get the part.
I said, I will do the movie if it is of, I will do a movie of another denomination, but not another faith.
I saw you've done quite a few movies. What's like one of your favorites you've done?
Gosh. I don't know. I tell you one. No, one that I had a lot of fun working on was Pawn Shop Chronicles. Everybody in the world was that. Of course, the campaign with Will Ferrell, you know, and
yeah,
and all the guys from Saturday Night. You know, I love that. It mm-hmm. was great. Dan was in it. You know, and I was really good friends with Dan and his brother. In fact, Dan and I had done projects together. Dan Aykroyd. Mm-hmm. So those were two that I really enjoyed. But there are other ones. I mean, all of them have some memories. It's easier to remember the ones that you didn't like.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's how it is with most things in life, I think.
And I think that generally starts out, whether it's a TV show or whether it's a movie or whatever, whoever is at the head of the totem pole, the star, if they've got an attitude and they're not nice, you know, mm-hmm. the whole production tends to run on pins and needles. It's like
who?
That. Well, I'm not, you know.
Let's hear some names.
I know, I'd rather say people that are very nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, for instance, like I did episodes of Murphy Brown in California. And, you know, the star of the show, she was just, you know, absolutely lovely. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember her name, but of course it was Candace Bergen. And, yeah, she was just beautiful and she was lovely. And she'd come out with her hair in rollers and no makeup and eat with you and the crew. And, mm-hmm. you know, was just as down to earth and nice as she could be and helpful. And I think that's important that you've got somebody that's like that, you know.
Totally, yeah.
If you got somebody with a lot of attitude and demanding and, you know, nasty and condescending to people, you know, there are no small actors. There are only small parts, you know. You know that part, you know.
Yeah.
You've heard that before. It's not true. But at any rate, you know.
Yeah. It goes a long way to just
that's what I
be
think.
Nice.
Yeah. That's what I think.
Wonderful. Well, I got to say, this has been a wild ride, and I'm so glad that you came into this because this has been a ball for us. I think that Brian and I just had a very good time doing this, so thank you so much.
Thanks so much, and let me take a moment here to plug the record.
Yeah, please do. Absolutely.
It is the new record is called No End to the End. There is no end to the end. That's No End to the End is the great title of the record. Mm-hmm. And it's 10 new original songs played by yours truly, engineered. It's a, you know, do-it-yourself record. And it'll be out on the Flatchest Record label And should have a release very soon, maybe even by St. Patrick's Day, if I'm lucky.
Okay.
But if not, at least by Jazz Fest.
So this episode, it should be released by then, and we'll put a link to it in the description so people can click right over. So
we were just checking out last night. Definitely worth a listen. It is fantastic.
Thank you. And you know, I'm going to do a digital release, too, you know, so it'll be available through any and all mediums in existence at this time. And I'd also say not just here in the South, but throughout the United States, the world, and the universe. And universe is yet discovered, except for the Pleiades, and I haven't worked a deal with them yet. So,
well, thank you. Thank you. This is a pleasure, and this was a ton of fun. So,
thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me here, guys, and gals.
The performances were a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Thank you. You were great.
Yeah, awesome.
Thank you. I really, really you're great.
If you're ever back in Nashville, we'll have to do it again.
Yes, let's do it again.
That'd be a lot of fun.
All right.
Hell yeah.
I'm bringing Jack Elliott with me.
There you go. How,